Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We'll be considering opposite points of the emotional compass on today's program, from hate and hostility to compassion and generosity. We'll begin with a dynamic perhaps fed by the intensity of anger, rhetoric, and polarization so prominent in the country today. Our first guest is a man who studies and researches hate groups. There is no shortage of such organizations across the country or in our own region. Joining me in studio is David Cunningham, professor of sociology at Washington University, and the author of Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan, and There's Something Happening Here, The New Left, The Klan, and FBI Counterintelligence. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Funny time of year to be talking about hate, but there's plenty of it to go around, isn't there?
Yes.
Let's begin with your definition of a hate group. What exactly is it?
Well, I think the most common definition of a hate group is an organization or collection of people that target others based on their perceived membership in a class of people. So typically it's targeting people based on identity. It can be racial, it can be religious, it can be related to sexual identity, sexual orientation. But the key thing is that it's not targeting particular individuals, although it does that as well, but it targets them based on their affiliation with this broader category.
There are a number of them in this area. Such as?
Yes. So the Southern Poverty Law Center is kind of the preeminent group that tracks these sorts of organizations quite closely. And certainly, you know, Missouri has a wide range of these sorts of groups, everything running from the Ku Klux Klan to other white supremacist organizations, but also neo-Nazi groups, groups that are explicitly anti-Muslim and organized in that way. And also Christian identity groups, which are strongly anti-Semitic.
What's the strongest group in our area?
That's a good question. You know, I think one of the things that we can say is that these groups, although this has certainly been a difficult and interesting year to think about these sorts of hate groups, none of these groups are what we would think of as mass membership organizations. So when we think about strength, we're really thinking largely about consistency and their ability to create an infrastructure for people to do things in their name. And I think if we look over the last, say, decade or so and extend beyond that, the Council of Conservative Citizens is probably the best known group that comes out of the St. Louis area.
Now, what exactly are the kinds of things they want done in their name?
Well, these are groups, this is a particular group that we might think of as a white nationalist organization. And this is a group that grew out of what people usually term the White Citizens Councils, which were very active in the Deep South during the Civil Rights era. And the Citizens Councils, in effect, operated like the Ku Klux Klan, but in a way that tended to bring in community leaders. And they wouldn't espouse violence directly. And what they would focus on is economic intimidation and really public relations around the promotion of things like segregation and white supremacy.
Drive people out of their communities, that sort of thing, get them, separate them somehow.
To certainly separate them somehow, which could be driving people out. It could also be keeping people, quote unquote, in their place, meaning if anyone was perceived to overstep those bounds, they would be sanctioned in some way.
We are hearing an awful lot these days, given the political climate, of what's called the alt-right. I'm assuming that there may be hate groups under this particular umbrella, that we wouldn't classify that very general term as a hate organization. Or would we?
Yeah, well, I mean, so the alt-right is a very nebulous term,
sure.
And this is something that's been bounced around very prominently, obviously, over the last few months. I mean, this is a loose collection of ideas, really, that has certain kinds of outlets, especially on the internet, that is focused, similarly to what I was just describing, on white nationalism.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a group that will espouse the idea that traditional America is under siege, in effect, you know, by multicultural forces. Political correctness is often seen as a culprit in that way, and there's a sense of trying to recapture an era prior to these things happening.
We have been associating the word white with a number of these groups, white supremacists and so on. Are there hate groups of other ethnic composition?
Well, that's a somewhat contended point in the sense that, you know, one of the other aspects of hate groups that I think is quite important is that these are always operating within a system of power. So when we think about hate groups, to my mind, I think it's quite important to understand that these are groups that most times are trying to, or what we might think of as reactionary. What they're trying to do is preserve or recapture some sort of traditional privilege. So if we think of a system of power, that could be racial. And so we can think of white citizens who are trying to think of the traditional privilege and advantage that whites have had and oftentimes enjoyed and throughout American history, and trying to preserve or recapture that.
Do these groups have any real power?
The particular organizations don't tend to have power, but I think the ideology that lies behind them is something that has tentacles that reach out into much more kind of mainstream circles. And we see party politics sometimes, but we also see people who might be seen as community leaders espousing ideas that aren't necessarily inconsistent with some of these ideologies, even though oftentimes they certainly wouldn't be seen as directly affiliated with these kinds of groups.
Do they play together, if I may put it that way, in terms of having any kind of any coordination between and amongst the groups?
In contemporary times, we see that much more often. You know, I feel like if you look back to the civil rights era, where a group like the KKK was quite prominent, we might have seen them as a mass membership organization, at least in the South. One of the things then is that these groups were quite territorial. So you'd had other white supremacist groups like the National Socialist Rights Party, the Citizens Councils that I had mentioned earlier. And these groups tended to be quite territorial. They felt like they were the preeminent group that was trying to maintain segregation in that area. What we've seen since the 1970s is a lot of blending of these groups. You can see things, you could see a Klan rally where you see Klansmen in KKK regalia, so these robes and the hoods, but you could also see things like swastikas on their arms. And that's something you never would have seen 50 years ago, let's say, where the Klan would have seen themselves as in competition with those sorts of neo-Nazis.
So they are operating more in the open than was the case in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these groups have very nebulous boundaries, and I think they have small memberships oftentimes, but also tend to band together because of that. And so sometimes you'd see leaders that would collaborate, and you'd see people coming together under this broader umbrella, and they sort of adopt the symbolism from a variety of these groups and traditions.
Are they growing in number? I mean, do we know if or maybe I should put it this way, is membership amongst these groups growing?
Well, I think what we can see is a broader arc. Starting in 2008, after the first election of President Obama, we saw a significant increase in the number of organizations that were active, hate organizations, and also the membership, the size of the memberships in some of these groups. And so this was an arc that began in 2008, extended pretty consistently through the 2012 election. And, you know, one of the things that we can see about those are really get organized kind of moments. These are sectors of the population that felt like the election of President Obama was meant that their sense of the country was under siege. This was a moment where they felt like we need to do something and organize. I feel like the current election, even though it's been more charged in these ways, have been less of a get organized moment and more of a get public moment. You know, these are groups that are drawing on the infrastructure that have grown over the last 8 years, and they're using that as a way to come more into the open and the kinds of events that we see associated with what these groups do. And when I say events, I mean anything from marches and gatherings to acts of violence, terror, and intimidation. That has certainly grown over the last several months.
They feel, I guess, if I'm interpreting what you said correctly, that they have some sort of political cover because of the kind of rhetoric that we've been hearing.
Yeah, they certainly feel like there's a climate that's more supportive of the kind of rhetoric that they've been espousing over time. And, you know, in some circles, that means that people feel like they have license to act on that rhetoric much more frequently than they would have in the past.
What is your impression of where we are right now with all of this?
I think that this is a dangerous time largely because of the dynamic I described, meaning that over the last 8 years, there's been this growth in infrastructure associated with hate groups, and that really provides a platform for the kinds of actions that we're seeing now within this climate. You know, and I feel like there can be wide-ranging effects of this, anything from direct victimization to kinds of broader social problems, really, that we'd see in communities. One of the things that I found about prior hate group activity, if we go back to the 1960s, is that communities where the KKK was active 50 years ago continue to exhibit higher rates of violent crime and often also have a different kind of charged political dynamic associated with them. And so these are durable effects.
What about the tendency toward violence today? Hate crime is hard to categorize. I know police have a difficult time. Certain criteria have to be met. But yeah. Do we have any sense of how violent these groups have been recently?
Well, you know, going back to the Southern Poverty Law Center, who, again, is tracking these kinds of things, they found that in the 15 days following the election, they identified 867 acts of violence or terror or intimidation perpetrated either by hate groups directly in an identifiable way or in their name. So that is a huge uptick in terms of the activity that we're seeing here.
It's one thing, as I indicated, to talk about hate crime. It's another thing to prove that the violence that's been perpetrated is, in fact, a hate crime. If you would, just explain why that is a difficult proposition.
Well, you know, oftentimes we see acts of either direct violence or violence to things like property, the defacement of things, et cetera, and they're drawing on the kinds of ideas and rhetoric that hate groups would. And sometimes that's quite straightforward. You see that they're targeting groups racially. You know, there's, you know, one instance in Mississippi recently where there was a burning of a historically African-American church and racial epithets written on the side of the church that was burned. That's a relatively straightforward case in the sense that we see this terrible act that creates very clear damage in the name of something that's explicitly racialized and is racist in that way. But oftentimes we see the attacks on particular individuals, they kind of overlap. I mean, certainly people's perceived ethnic status or religious status or other kinds of things can certainly be motivational in that way, but they might intersect with other kinds of disagreements that people may have had or the way in which that they would have intersected or a particular charged environment. And in that case, you have multiple things going on, and we can be expansive about it and understand that the racialized or contentious climate created a basis for that. But we can also explain it in terms more in terms of interpersonal conflict. And that's a real gray area, certainly.
Sure. And that it's difficult for law enforcement to interpret exactly what's going on unless there is a specific thing said or, you know, perhaps some graffiti or something associated with the crime. Have to take a break now. We're talking with David Cunningham, a professor of sociology at Washington University and an author, and we're talking about hate crimes. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation on hate crimes with Professor David Cunningham of Washington University. I have a note here from one of our producers that is mentioning something that I was not aware of, and she's asking, why is the Nation of Islam considered a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center? I didn't realize that it was.
Yeah, well, they have a whole category of groups that they refer to as black separatist groups. And so in the St. Louis area, you see the Nation of Islam and also the New Black Panther Party. And the SPLC considers this a category in the sense that their central criterion is that these are groups that may target others based on a particular mode of classification or identity. So within that framework, groups that are seen as separatist or racist in this way can kind of go either way. And they make the distinction. They're clear that they say, well, they understand that a black separatist inclination is rooted in a long history of white racism and it can be a reaction to that. But they say that the effects can kind of go both ways. And so we need to be attentive to groups across the spectrum. I think there are other efforts that are more demarcated by that. And as I was saying before, if we understand hate crime and hate groups as operating within a system of power, they would argue that that it's something distinct from that when we see groups that typically have been targeted by hate groups organizing in this sort of separatist way, and they wouldn't fall within that kind of spectrum.
Do most states, most communities have hate crime laws, or is this basically a federal situation?
That's a good question. I mean, certainly there are federal classifications that we're dealing with, but what we do see is a huge variation locally in terms of both how crimes are classified and understood and then how they're dealt with in that way. And one of the things that we actually see are the main determinant of the level of hate crime that we see in certain places. Obviously, the level of activity is going to matter, but the other thing is going to be the degree to which communities are mobilizing. They're certainly aware of hate crimes, but they're also mobilizing in opposition to them. And so often we see communities that are quite progressive in these ways have fairly high levels of hate crime, both because of maybe contention that lies behind that, but also there's a strong movement to encourage people to identify hate crimes when they see them and to report them. And so then that filters up to the federal statute level.
How about state laws?
I think we see most of the action here is our a federal push to identify state crimes or hate crimes. So the FBI can be involved, et cetera. And then we see this local enforcement dynamic. Certainly, the state enforcement can come into the equation, but it tends to be in the middle of those two levels.
How about in this immediate vicinity? Then, do you have any awareness of what the laws are like here?
I don't have a strong awareness, you know, as being relatively new to St. Louis.
I wanted to point that out. You are new. Yeah. Okay. Well, perhaps some of our listeners will have some sense of that. I asked that question because I'd had a tweet earlier in the day at home as to what can be done to limit these groups in state or local ordinances. But I think you've made that clear. Pretty much the local ordinances can deal with it if they choose to.
Certainly, and there can be collaborative partnerships that are very effective in many places where local officials are often coordinating with civic efforts and sometimes activist efforts to really mobilize around both the recognition of hate crimes and opposition to hate crimes. And so you see oftentimes these kinds of partnerships that I think are the most robust and effective ways of tackling this particular kind of issue.
Let's take a call. We have Brandt, who's been waiting to get into the conversation. Let's bring him in. He's calling from St. Louis. Brandt, go ahead. You're on the air with Professor Cunningham.
Thanks, Don. I spend a great deal of my time helping immigrants, especially from Afghanistan and Iran, resettle here. And I would say 80% of my friends are immigrants. And I worked with inner city kids for 6 years. Okay, so I'm all about diversity. But I also want to say that I think that there's a lot of crying wolf in a lot of situations. A lot of what you say is true. But there's a lot of the narrative that is just blown out of proportion, really on both sides. And I see this all the time. And I take in media from all perspectives.
So, Brandt, give me an example, would you?
Okay. Well, with the Black Lives Matter thing, okay, sometimes, you know, and we're going to have to get together over coffee, I think, or a beer, Don, to really go through this. But there's a lot of examples of, you know, where the narrative is slanted, especially on NPR. But I hear it on 97.1 Talk, too. And there's a lot of things that are scary on there, okay? And, you know, there's just a lot of one sides to these things, okay? And, you know, we don't hear the other side. I don't hear on NPR the side that I hear on 97.1. But they make some good points on both sides, okay? So I think that democracy is best served when both sides are represented.
Okay, Brandt, thanks for the call, and congratulations to you for listening to both sides. A lot of people these days don't bother to do that, but thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
One of the things in response to that I would say is that I appreciate the efforts, the orientation of groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, which I know we've mentioned several times, because when they are engaging with this issue, these issues, and tracking both organizations and events, they have a very careful definition of what constitutes a hate crime. They have very clear criterion of what constitutes an organization and how they identify them. And certainly the kinds of events that they look at are identifiable. These aren't hearsay kinds of events. Or events that don't have any traces of evidence and certainly direct victimhood associated with them. And so when we see a significant uptick based on those criterion, it's clear that we're seeing something that can be perpetrated either by organizations that we've been speaking of or in their name. And certainly we also see it's also clear who the targets of those kinds of actions are.
You know, I'd want to go back to the election for just a moment, because I wonder if you, given your research and the attention you pay to this, had any kind of a sense that there was a mobilization, an attempt to mobilization, the voting power of these particular groups during the last election?
I certainly think that there was sometimes direct and oftentimes indirect or coded kind of nodding to that to that area. I mean, certainly President-elect Trump's failure to quickly and steadfastly denounce the support of KKK leaders like David Duke really kind of signaled something. And there was, a sense that wasn't direct support of that necessarily, but a way that sort of said, well, this is something that can be in bounds in a way that it has not been in bounds in mainstream American politics over the last half century. So I certainly, think that the numbers of members of these groups are certainly not significant enough to sway anything like a national election. But the broader constituency that might feel aggrieved by some of the issues that these groups take up is a much more significant number. So I think there is an effort to have that delicate balancing act.
And of course, in close elections, it could be a determinative factor.
Certainly.
We have an email from Madonna who writes, I hear from many of my conservative family that they have a problem with the term hate crime. They say all crime is hate crime, and then complain that crimes against certain people shouldn't be more important than any other crimes. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we do have a distinction between crime that is against individuals for a whole range of reasons and crime that might target an individual, a group, or a gathering place based on a perceived sense of broader group affiliation. I mean, the thing about hate crimes is that they have direct victims, but really the target tends to be the group or the kinds of people that those victims represent. And to me, that's a very different kind of dynamic, because it's not just about the direct victimhood. It's about sending a message about what lies behind that kind of crime and who could be victimized moving forward.
If you take the word crime out of this equation, just talk about hate groups, what kinds of protections, legal protections, do they have under our Constitution?
Well, certainly, constitutionally, there's freedom of speech is probably the primary one, where the kind of rhetoric they espouse, even if it lends itself to the kinds of criminal actions that we've been discussing, is going to be constitutionally protected. We also have, another dynamic, and we saw this, the buildup to the recent claim that the Klan was going to have a march in North Carolina in celebration of the recent election. Certainly, there's a freedom of assembly. So the gathering of these kinds of groups in celebration of their kinds of rhetoric, this is something that's obviously protected as well. And so, we see their right to exist is something that would be protected, and that runs everything from the kinds of ideas that they're going to espouse and the kinds of public ways that they're going to espouse them. But we also have this being bounded in the sense that acting on those ideas is clearly both in terms of from a criminal standpoint and also in terms of protection of other people's constitutional rights is difficult.
They're certainly easy to find on the internet. I mean, they're all over the place and very active. And that disturbs a lot of people that they have this kind of access to the world at large.
Yeah, I mean, certainly over the last, say, 15 years, the internet has provided a whole different platform for these kinds of groups. And, you know, if you think of any kind of group that might not have a large constituency that they can identify locally, you know, these are groups that both can spread their message out far and wide online, but also in a way that provides some degree of anonymity. So people can respond, they can explore, they can participate in these communities in ways that don't necessarily threaten their ability to keep a job and do other kinds of things where sometimes they may see their affiliation with, say, a neo-Nazi group or a white supremacist group as stigmatizing in their public life. So it both provides access to lots of people and it provides a way for those people to link into these movements without necessarily publicly proclaiming that in a direct way.
Well, if this is certainly, if there is an increase in this country, an increase in activity and a greater openness, I wonder how we stack up with other countries. And we're reading so much these days about movement shifting to the right in many European countries. Yeah. Where are we in that whole mix?
Well, I mean, I think the kinds of things, especially involving issues like immigration, religious diversity, these kinds of issues, I think that the dynamic that we're seeing here and that you're describing matches on to what we see certainly in Europe these days, and the nativist tendencies that we're seeing here. I mean, these are global kinds of issues, and certainly other people have an eye on what's happening in the U.S., but also vice versa. And I think we see what's happening in Europe in that sense, and issues around migration and immigration are going to continue to be at the fore during this kind of charged time and this really unstable time in a lot of ways, politically, economically, and otherwise.
Should we be alarmed about where we are and where we may be heading?
Well, I think we're in a really uncertain time, and it's not necessarily clear exactly where we're heading. I think if policy follows the sort of rhetoric that we've seen in this last election cycle, I think this is a dangerous time because a lot of the values that we've promoted as a nation and we've celebrated as a nation, certainly over the last half century, and you know, ideas that come out of the civil rights movement and a lot of the legislation in that way, this is really something that's both threatened, but also the framework that we've used to kind of move forward and make decisions in the political realm also really are on a shaky foundation at this point.
And so, as these groups become more brazen, if you will, that just exacerbates the problem.
Yeah, I mean, certainly as someone who's primarily done research on hate groups during the civil rights era, I think we see lots of parallels in terms of the emboldenedness of the groups that oppose issues around diversity, multiculturalism, and social justice.
So what do we do? What do we do as individuals? They've got the right to speak out as long as they don't overdo it, if you will. What do we as individuals do?
I think vigilance around these issues is really important in terms of both speaking out and mobilizing against these sorts of efforts. And I think in a civic sense, this is very important because communities in the past that have allowed hate groups to exist in their midst unchallenged have really not only led to further acts of terror and intimidation perpetrated by those groups, but also have suffered as communities. And what you see over time is a sense that it delegitimizes authority oftentimes, it kind of breaks down social fabric, and it also sort of destabilizes a community's ability to act together and have any sort of solidarity in terms of moving forward. And so I think that kind of counter-mobilization is really the way to take a strong stand about what is valued and what's tolerated within a community.
Well, it's not only communities. As we learned in the not too distant past, it also destabilizes nations.
Certainly.
We have David Cunningham. Cunningham, I want to thank you so much for being with us and talking about this. It's an important subject. David is a professor of sociology at Washington University and the author of Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.